Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. The Subha Sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sāvatthī in Jeta's Grove, Anātta Pindika's Park. Now on that occasion the Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, was staying at the residence of a certain household in Sāvatthī for some business or other. Then the Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, asked the householder in whose residence he was staying, "Householder, I have heard that Sāvatthī is not devoid of arahats." We're doing the Subha Sutta, so there's some on there if you haven't got your book with you. "Householder, I have heard that Sāvatthī is not devoid of arahats. What recluse or Brahmin may we go to today to pay our respects?" "Venerable sir," said the householder, "this Blessed One is living at Sāvatthī in Jeta's Grove and not at Pindika's Park. You may go to pay your respects to that Blessed One, Venerable sir." So this is what people used to do on a free afternoon, to see what enlightened ones were in town and go and pay them a visit, go and check them out. Apparently they don't do that in Perth these days. On a free afternoon they don't say, "What arahats are there in Perth this afternoon?" Things have changed. Then, having assented to the householder, the Brahmin student Subha Todaya's son went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and asked the Blessed One. And in Nepali that means when he just exchanged greetings with him, it meant he wasn't a disciple, he was just saying, like, "Good day." Usually they bow if they are a disciple. So this tells us he wasn't a disciple, he was just going to check the Buddha out. "Master Gotama," says Subha, "the Brahmins say this, the householder is the one accomplishing the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome, the one gone forth into homelessness," in other words, you and those bald-headed, lazy people, "are not accomplishing the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. What does Master Gotama say about this?" So very confronting. Basically he's saying, you know, we're doing the right way, according to our tradition, but you're not. What do you say about this? So even then, people would be quite confronting and ask tough questions of monks. And we always encourage people to ask tough questions, even today. So please don't be overly respectful to the point that there are questions which should be asked, which you don't ask. So, asking the Buddha, you know, basically, who is practicing the best way? And the Buddha, again, very skillful answer. He's not just saying, "Of course, you know, the monks, you know, we practice the best way, and you lay people a bunch of lazy, hopeless cases." Listen how the Buddha answered here, because it's a very beautiful way of answering questions, even which you were asked. "Here, student, I am one who speaks after making an analysis. I do not speak one-sidedly. In other words, I don't make generalizations. I do not praise the wrong way of practice on the part either of a householder or one gone forth. For whether it be a householder or one gone forth, one who has entered on the wrong way of practice, by reason of the wrong way of practice, is not accomplishing the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. I praise the right way of practice on the part of either a householder or one gone forth. But whether it be a householder or one gone forth, one who has entered on the right way of practice by reason of that right way of practice is accomplishing the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome." In other words, it doesn't matter who you are, but what you're doing makes it wholesome or not wholesome. "Master Gotama, the Brahmins say this, since the work of the household life involves a great deal of activity, great functions, great engagements, and great undertakings, it is of great fruit. But since the work of those gone forth involves a small amount of activity, small functions and small engagements and small undertakings. It is a small fruit. What does Master Gotama say about that? Here too, student, I am one who speaks after making an analysis. I do not speak one-sidedly. There is work involving a great deal of activity, great functions, great engagements, and great undertakings, which, when it fails, is a small fruit. There is work involving a great deal of activity, great functions, engagements, and undertakings, which, when it succeeds, is of great fruit. And there is work involving a small amount of activity, small functions, small engagements, and small undertakings, which, when it fails, is a small fruit. And the same work, small work, which is sometimes, when it succeeds, of great fruit. So in other words, it doesn't matter whether it's big undertakings or small undertakings, sometimes great fruit, sometimes small fruit. What, student, is that work involving a great deal of activity, which, when it fails, is a small fruit? Agriculture is that work involving a great deal of activity, which, when it fails, is of small fruit. Remember, there's an agricultural society, so quite understandably, you know, if you do agriculture, it's a huge amount of work, and if there's a drought or the crops fail, you don't get anything back at all. And what, student, is that work involving a great deal of activity, which, when it succeeds, is of great fruit? Agriculture, again, is that work involving a great deal of activity, which, when it succeeds, is of a great fruit. And what, student, is that work involving a small amount of activity, which, when it fails, is a small fruit? He says, trade. Is that work involving a small amount of activity, which, when it fails, is a small fruit? And what, student, is that work involving a small amount of activity, which, when it succeeds, is of great fruit? Great fruit. Serving on the Buddhist Society Committee. Is that work involving a small amount of activity? Oh no, that's not what it says. Small amount of activity, but great fruit. And they have trade here, but they didn't have a Buddhist Society of Western Australia. If they did these days, they would say, helping out the temple is a small activity, but great fruit. Just as agriculture, student, is work that involves a great deal of activity, but is of small fruit when it fails, so the work of the household life involves a great deal of activity, great functions, great engagements, and great undertakings, but it is of small fruit when it fails. Just as agriculture is work that involves a great deal of activity and is of great fruit when it succeeds, so the work of the household life involves a great deal of activity, great functions, engagements, and undertakings, and is a great fruit when it does succeed. Just as trade is work that involves a small amount of activity, is a small fruit when it fails, so the work of those gone forth, you know, the monks and the nuns, involves a small amount of activity, small functions, engagements, and undertakings, it's a small fruit when it fails. But just as trade is work that involves a small amount of activity, but is of great fruit when it succeeds, so the work of those gone forth involves a small amount of activity, functions, engagements, undertakings, but it's of great fruit when it succeeds. So again, he's saying it doesn't really, he's not saying whether you're a layperson or you're a monk or a nun, it's just to say, now how you do this, to see whether it's going to be of great fruit. And well, obviously there's some monks and some nuns who don't succeed, and their holy life is a small fruit, some who are of great fruit. And the same in the world as well. So it's a nice way of not answering a question without really upsetting this Brahmin, who you see in a few moments is really trying to upset the Buddha. Master Gotama, they're very proud, these Brahmins. The Brahmins prescribe 5 things for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. Because everyone in those days was into making merit, making good karma, for accomplishing the wholesome, the skillful. And even the Buddha here, he's not that arrogant. He doesn't ask a question of the Brahmin. If it is not troublesome for you, student, please state in this assembly the 5 things that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. It is not troublesome for me, Master Gotama, when such venerable ones as you and others are sitting in this assembly. Then state them, student. Master Gotama, truth is the first thing that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. Asceticism is the second thing. Celibacy is the third. Study is the fourth. And generosity is the 5th thing that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. These are the five things that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. What does Master Gotama say about this? How then, students, among the Brahmins, is there even a single Brahmin who says thus, I declare the result of these five things, having realized it myself with direct knowledge? In other words, does anyone really practice these things and see if they work? No, Master Gotama. How then, student, among the Brahmins, is there even a single teacher or teacher's teacher, back to the seventh generation of teachers, who says this, I declare the result of these things, five things, having realized it myself with direct knowledge? No, Master Gotama, because in the Brahmin tradition, they're always going back to the lineage of your teachers and teachers' teachers. How then, student, the ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, whose ancient hymns they were formerly chanted, uttered and compiled, the Brahmins nowadays still chant and repeat, repeating what was spoken, reciting what was recited, these are the Vedas. That is, Ataka, Vamaka, Vamadeva, Vesamita, Yamatagi, Angirasa, Bhavadvaja, Vaseta, Kasapa, and Bhagu. So I don't know who those guys are, but in those days they were really famous. Did even these ancient Brahmin seers say thus, we declare the result of these five things having realized it ourselves with direct knowledge? No, Master Gotama. So in other words, it's just knowledge which is handed down, but no one says they've actually realized it for themselves or know exactly what happens if you do these five things for the performance of merit. So, student, it seems that among the Brahmins there is not even a single Brahmin who says thus, I declare the result of these five things having realized it myself with direct knowledge. And among the Brahmins there is not even a single teacher or a single teacher's teacher, back to the seventh generation of teachers, who says thus, I declare the result of these five things having realized it myself with direct knowledge. And the ancient Brahmin seers, the creators of the hymns, the composers of the hymns, even these ancient Brahmin seers did not say thus, we declare the result of these five things, having realized it ourselves with direct knowledge. Suppose there were a file of blind men, each in touch with the next. The first one does not see, the middle one does not see, and the last one does not see. So, too, student, in regard to their statement, the Brahmins seem to be like a file of blind men. First one don't see, middle one don't see, and the last one don't see. Pretty mean, but you know, when you get the blind leading the blind, that statement, you can see that 2,500 years ago the Buddha was using that simile. Now, where does the simile of the blind leading the blind come from in English? Is it in the Christian Bible, or where is it? Does anyone know? I see. It came originally from Buddhism. I always suspected that Jesus was a Buddhist. And this is where it all came from. I don't know. But you see, the main point of this is that some of these teachings, which is Brahmins or others, or maybe even you, sort of hold on to and defend at all costs. Have you realized these teachings for yourself with direct knowledge, or is this coming from somebody else? And those people it's coming from, do they say, yes, I know this from direct experience? If they don't, then maybe it's a bit dodgy, like the blind leading the blind. Before I go on, any comments or questions so far? No? Okay, you never make a Brahmin. You have to be very aggressive and ask tough questions. Okay, and as far as the Brahmin, Subha, when this was said, the Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, was angry and displeased with the simile of the fire of blind men. And he reviled, disparaged, and censured the Blessed One, saying thus, the recluse Gotama will be worsted. Worsted, it means be defeated. You know, you're going to get into big trouble, Gotama, for saying things like this about the Brahmins. Then he said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, the Brahmin Pokarasati of the Upamanya clan, the Lord of the Subhaga Grove, says thus, some recluses and Brahmins here claim superhuman states, distinctions in knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones. But what they say turns out to be ridiculous. It turns out to be mere words, empty and hollow. For how could a human being know or see or realize a superhuman state a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of noble ones. That is impossible. The Brahmins believe those sorts of states are only reserved for gods. How could a human being fly through the air? Only birds can do that. How can they read your mind? Maybe only a superhuman god can do that. How can they do all these magical powers, like passing through walls? Only David Copperfield can do that. On TV, apparently. No, it isn't. That's just TV. No, see, this cannot be done by human beings. It's impossible. It's just like sometimes people say about, you know, all this other stuff which, you know, some monks say they've seen or done. You know, they think, yeah, it can't be done. Now, levitation. Have you ever seen anyone levitating? Can it be done? Have you ever seen people reading people's minds? Or even, you know, getting into jhanas. Can it be done? Really? Now, this is what he was actually saying. These are impossible. So the Buddha has actually been challenged here. All these amazing stuff. Is it really possible? How then, student? Does a Brahmin poke a sati, understand the minds of all requisite Brahmins, having encompassed them with his own mind? Can he read their minds? Can Pokrasati read the minds of other monks and nuns? Master Gotama, the Brahmin Pokrasati, does not even understand the mind of his slave woman, Punika, having encompassed it with his own mind. If he can't read his own slave woman's mind, how could he understand thus the minds of all requisites of Brahmins? Student, there's another nice simile here. Suppose there were a man born blind, who could not see dark and light forms, who could not see blue, yellow, red or pink forms, who could not see what was even and uneven, who could not see the stars or the sun and the moon. He might say thus, there are no dark and light forms, and no one who sees dark and light forms. There are no blue, yellow, red or pink forms, and no one who sees these colours. There is nothing even or uneven, and no one who sees anything even and uneven. And as far as the star and the sun and the moon, there are no such things. There are no stars, no sun and the moon, and no one who sees the stars and the sun and the moon. I can't see these things. I don't know these things. Therefore, they don't exist. Speaking thus, student, would he be speaking rightly? No, Master Gotama. There are dark and light forms, and those who see dark and light forms. There are stars and the sun and the moon, and there are those who see the stars and the sun and the moon, saying, I do not know these, I do not see these, therefore they do not exist. He would not be speaking rightly. And that's actually what the Buddha wanted to get out of here. Just because you have not experienced it yet for yourself, I haven't seen these things, therefore they can't exist. You're not speaking rightly. Talking about the superhuman, the deep attainments. So, too, student, the Brahmin Pokrasati is blind and visionless. That he could know or see or realize a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision, worthy of the noble ones, this is impossible. What do you think, student? What is better for those well-to-do Brahmins of Kosala, such as the Brahmin Chanki, Taruka, Pokrasati, Janusoni, or your father, Brahmin Todaya, but the statements they make accord with worldly convention or flawed worldly convention? That they accord with worldly convention, Master Gotama. In other words, if you don't know for yourself, you're not really sure, it's best maybe just to follow the convention. But if you do know for yourself, you can break convention. What is better for them, that the statements they make be thoughtful or thoughtless? Thoughtful. What is better for them, that they make their statements after reflecting or without reflecting? After reflecting. What is better for them, that the statements they make be beneficial or unbeneficial? Beneficial, Master Gotama. What do you think, student? If that is so, did the statement made by the Brahmin Pokrasati accord with worldly convention or flaunt worldly convention? It flaunted worldly convention, Master Gotama. Was the statement made thoughtful or thoughtless? Thoughtless, Master Gotama. Was the statement made after reflecting or without reflecting? Yeah, without reflecting, I suppose, Master Gotama. Was the statement made beneficial or unbeneficial? Unbeneficial, Master Gotama. So I added the emphasis there. That's not in the book. The R's and the M's. So even though you don't see it for yourself, at least you should keep an open mind to it instead of saying, yeah, there's certainly no moon and stars because I can't see them. to these superhuman states. Perhaps they do exist. It's the same as when people say there's no ghosts. I remember talking to Abbot Placid, you know, the Benedictine monks. I was always interested to actually compare notes with our different traditions and asked him if he believed in ghosts. You know, the Abbot Placid of New Norcian Monastery, he said, no, no, in Catholic tradition we don't believe in ghosts. I said, what about the Holy Ghost? He said, okay, that one, yeah, okay. I was having fun with him. That's the only ghost they believe in, the Holy Ghost. Other ghosts, no. But anyway, do you believe in ghosts? Just because you haven't seen them yet does not mean they do not exist. Maybe you just haven't gone to the right place. Maybe there is a right place, but you're too afraid to go there at night time, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Then you... I remember going to this really one of the spookiest places I've ever been to. It was a cemetery at Christmas Island. And I got lots and lots of stories. You know, Christmas Island, just between here and Malaysia. And it's lots and lots of stories. This one person told me that when the casino was running on Christmas Island, the shortest way from the main township to the casino was along this coast road. Trouble was that it actually passed by the cemetery. And it was the most spookiest of places, so right next to the ocean. And every day I go, whoosh! And it was actually just a wave hitting the rocks. Maybe. It was dark and spooky there. And people said that there was another road that was about 4 or 5 kilometers more distant. But most people went the long way round. Because the story was, and I was told a story too, the one person took the shortcut by the cemetery. You know, this is mostly Chinese people. And the Chinese people, they love gambling. So that there was a person standing in the middle of the road. And I was saying there was a lady, so I'm not quite sure, she was working at the casino. Stopped her. No, so it was a bloke. Stopped her with his arms out. And had to stop. And demanded to go to the casino. So she had to open the door and let him in. And of course she was terrified and shaking. But fortunately, when he got to the casino, he got out of the car and went through. She was convinced it was a ghost. But worse than that, when she finished her shift, the ghost was waiting for her to get the lift back home. And wanted to be let off just outside the cemetery. She had no choice. Shaking, perspiring, she drove to the cemetery and he got out and disappeared into the cemetery. It was a ghost who spent a night out gambling. Oh, and after that, no, I went past that much. But, you know, you ask people, many people have seen ghosts, or at least heard them. But unless you've actually seen them or heard them yourself, it's just like a person who's blind. Right? You know, there are no stars, there are no sun and moon. So you never know. But especially the supernormal powers. Now, Buddha gets on to this is the Dharma part of this. Well, all Dharma, but this is like the deeper part. Now there are these 5 hindrances, student, and these are the 5 hindrances, you know, the Panchanivarana, the 5 Nivaranas. These are the ones which, number 1, stop you getting into jhana, number 2, stop you seeing things as they truly are. And the Buddha said they stop you getting still, and they stop you, they weaken wisdom. Now there is 5 hindrances, student. What are the 5? The hindrance of sensual desire, the hindrance of ill will, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, the hindrance of restlessness and remorse, and the hindrance of doubt, the 5 hindrances. These are the 5 hindrances. That Brahmin or Pokasati is obstructed, hindered, blocked, and enveloped by these 5 hindrances. That he could know or see or realize a superhuman state, a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, that's impossible. That's the first and important piece of, if you like, Buddhist dogma, you know, based on experience, that in order actually to have supernatural experiences or get that type of mind which can do those sorts of things, most people, they have to abandon those 5 hindrances. And if you want to see, like, past lives, even I was talking to Dennis yesterday, and he has been doing all these wonderful regressions and getting people to get into their past lives. But you can, even like regression, it's almost like you get a person that by hypnotizing them, you know, you're getting them beyond their 5 hindrances. Temporarily. So they can remember who they were in the past. da, da, da. You see, one interesting story, I think I can tell this, there's no names, because it was not in this city, it was another city in Australia. There was a lady who, her mother was so concerned about her daughter who was anorexic. And the doctor wasn't really helping them, so they knew this person who was a really good hypnotist, and maybe like through hypnotism, you know, you can actually get this girl to start eating again, or at least maybe regress her to find out what the original cause of the problem was. So they regressed this young lady, and she was very, very beautiful apparently, young, beautiful, but, you know, sick with anorexia. Regressed her, and it wasn't that hard to actually regress her, and she came out with a previous life, that she was one of two sisters. She had an old elder sister, she was the youngest. Her elder sister was beautiful, she was quite plain in comparison. And they both fell in love with the same guy. And of course, the guy chose the beautiful girl. You know, guys being guys, the guys seeing, you know what I'm talking about. And so the guy chose her elder sister and married the elder sister. And she was heartbroken and committed suicide. And that was the original cause of her anorexia. Now, so the intention, she must be beautiful, because that ruined her previous life. Unfortunately, though, that when the mother heard that, you know, she was almost shaky. Because the mother, when she was growing up, had a younger sister who fell in love with the man she eventually married and committed suicide. Her daughter, she found, was her sister in her previous life. But once they found out what is all going on, obviously they realized that they could make amends. So the reason why she got reborn again in that family, because, you know, she loved that man her sister married, which was her father in this time. So she could still express her love this time to that guy as her father. It's amazing what can happen. But anyway, apparently you can do things like that. You know, only with the abandonments of the five hindrances. So yeah, there are these. You can't call those superhuman states. Or sometimes do those without hypnosis, if you can get into the states where the five hindrances have gone. But he says that's why Poco-Sati can't do these things. They're just going on hearsay or what the tradition said. They don't know it for themselves. Paragraph 16. Are there any comments about that, first of all? Any comments or questions? Okay. Wow, you're very quiet today. Now, paragraph 16. There are these five causes of sensual pleasure. Student, what are the five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desire, agreeable and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear. Odors cognizable by the nose. Flavors cognizable by the tongue, and tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with the sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five causes of sensual pleasure. In other words, the five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. How many senses are there in Buddhism? Six. Notice always, in Buddhism, I point this out, the five senses, that's called like sensuality. And the sixth sense, the mind, even that's got greater happiness, that's always separated out. In other places, Arana Vibhanga Sutra is a classic sutra, the five sense pleasures, they're one thing. The pleasures of the mind are another thing. And the Buddha said, if you really want to have a good time, forget about those five senses and go for the mind pleasure. But anyway, those are the five senses. The Brahmin Poco-Sati is tied to these five cause of sensual pleasure, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them. He enjoys them without seeing the danger in them or understanding the escape from them. That he could know or see or realize a superhuman state of distinction in knowledge and vision, worthy and noble ones, that's impossible. This is actually saying how you can understand these deeper teachings or deeper experiences by overcoming the five hindrances and by thereby letting go of the five senses. That's actually how you see amazing things. Now, what do you think? This is a very interesting simile here, which is a simile about the jhanas. Because the word jhana, these deep meditations, it comes from like a word jayati, which is the same word as meaning to burn. And so there's a etymological connection between fire and flame and these deep meditations. And this is actually exploited here in this simile. And I mention this because it makes a simile much more meaningful when you understand that jhana means almost like fire, almost like the mind on fire, in the sense of, in the English word, to be on fire, just really getting into it. What do you think, student? Which of these two fires would have a better flame, colour and radiance? A fire that may burn in dependence on fuel, such as grass and wood, or a fire that may be burned independent of the fuel, such as grass and wood? Now, which fire would be a better colour? If it were possible, Master Gotama, for a fire to burn independent of fuel, such as grass and wood, that fire would have a better flame, colour and radiance. It is impossible, student, it cannot happen that a fire could burn independent of some fuel, such as grass or wood, except through the exercise of supernormal power. Like the fire that burns dependent on fuel, such as grass and wood, I say is the rapture that is dependent upon the five course of sensual pleasure. Like the fire that burns independent of fuel, such as grass and wood, is the rapture that is apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states. I'll come back to that soon in a few moments. And what, student, is the rapture that is apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states? And of course you all know, listen to me long enough. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, the meditator enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied not by a movement of the mind which goes on to the object and stays with the object, with rapture and pleasure born of the seclusion. This is a rapture apart from sensual pleasure, apart from unwholesome states. Again, with a stilling of applied and sustained movement of the mind, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. This too is a rapture apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states. Of those five things, he just does a second jhana, that's enough for now, because he's talking about that rapture. Of those five things, okay, so this is actually like a fire, which the Buddha said is burning independent of fuel, having a much greater radiance. Now, the other word for fuel, the word for fuel here, anyone knows what the word for fuel is? You listen to my talks? Yeah, that's right, upadana. Same word we use for attachments, or fuel. Because in Pali, you can understand a fuel is the energy attaches on to the source of the fuel. Now, like the fire attaches on to the grass, sticks to the grass, and therefore there's an attachment there, and that's where the fuel comes from. The idea of attachment, fuel, is exactly the same. You can get like fuel attachment and see, you know, how those two words can work together. That's what we're talking about here. So any person reading this in Pali would understand this is like the jhanas are the raptures without the attachments, not fueled by things. They're purer. So here he's actually talking about how we experience those supernormal states, and the jhanas themselves are supposed to be called superhuman states. And this is how you do it, by detaching yourself from the five sense pleasures so your mind can burn on something outside those sense pleasures. It's not a grass or a wood fire anymore. It's something which burns independent of that. And you have to let go of the five hindrances. So that's a very unique simile there, where the Buddha is talking about the jhanas as burning independent of fuel. That's why also they can last for a long, long time. The sensory pleasures, you know, you always have to have fuel. You know, when your fish and chips runs out, then the pleasure runs out. You know, when the movie is finished, then the pleasure is gone. And you have to find something else. But when jhana keeps on going, goes on for a long time, and afterwards it keeps on going a long time. Any comments or questions about that before I keep going? Ah, you're so quiet. Come on, Hong, you can ask a question. It's, well, in the sense that in the prior sermon, the Buddha actually, it was the third sermon of the Buddha, the third teaching, he said, you know, the eye is on fire, the ears are on fire, you know, the whole six senses are on fire with lust. In other words, the idea of the fire destroying everything. So that was one of the, obviously, the first similes, but those were the fire worshippers, so he was trying to give a teaching which was connected to their basic spiritual practice of fire. But I think it's not really, I can't really ask your question in the affirmative. It just seems, and I haven't really discovered fully why it was that the word jhana for meditation now had the same root as to burn. We also have like the other Pali word is tapas, which means like spiritual endeavor, which is also fire. And they also sometimes call that spiritual heat. So it was, you know, someone is really practicing a lot, they're really trying to get into their meditation, they're doing really lots of things, they really are committed and really going for it. They say that's somebody who's really got a lot of tapas, or spiritual fire. And it was the same as like fire. So they have some similes with, you know, what we say, we're on fire. In other words, we're really sort of very ardent and vigorous in whatever we're doing. That's another simile which is often, like the fire has gone out. They call, like, one of the epithets, descriptions of an arahat is siti bhuto, and become cool. In other words, the fire gone out. And one of the similes also for the anagami, the non-returner, is like this hot spark. And that hot spark, sort of, which is, you know, the anagami when they died, sometimes that hot spark goes up, and before it falls down, it's extinguished in the space in between. And for those of you who know this controversy, the space in between is called the antarbhava. It's the one very clear place in the suttas where the Buddha is talking about a space between rebirth. This birth has ended. You haven't really taken a next rebirth. In the space in between, there's a time for the anagami to be fully extinguished. So they end this life as an anagami, but they don't even get to the pure abode, the sudawasa. They go out in between. So I mention that because if you talk to Buddhist monks, especially monks who have studied the Abhidharma and believe the Abhidharma to be the word of the Buddha, they always say, Buddha said there's no in-between state, no antarbhava. In other words, as soon as you die, you go straight up to heaven, or you go straight down to hell, or straight into a human birth, or you're straight into the ghost realm, and you can't actually have these states where people are hanging about and coming to see you in your dreams, saying, Om, Om, Om. You haven't paid off those debts yet. Ong, ong, ong. You know where that will is. Ong, ong, ong. Whatever it is. Those are ghostly people just after a person dies. And so many people have seen those. It's obviously it's true. Before they get reborn, they can come and see you. And that's one place where there's an antarbhava. And they use the simile of like just a hot spark. So it's hardly any fire left, but it's hot spark. And it just before it reaches the ground, it goes out. So, siti bhuto, completely cool, no fire left. Does that make sense? So the use of the word fire in early Buddhism has many, many metaphors. I don't know if they all converge on the one meaning. I think they're separate metaphors. But they were used then, and we do use them now. It's still burning, but it's obviously in a very positive way. It may be just because of the nimittas preceding Dharma, the beautiful, brilliant light like the sun burning. But, or it might be burning up defilements. It'd be very interesting to understand why, but from all my readings of the suttas and experiences, I can't see any obvious explanation to why there's the word jhana was used for deep meditation. You know, I remember sort of, just again, just going back even to the Christian Bible. In the Old Testament, know, according to their tradition, the Jewish tradition, whenever like a god appeared, it would be like flames, like a burning bush, and fire. And sometimes, you know, you wonder, maybe that's just like the strong imitators which can arise. And that's maybe how it's seen. And I know that when devas appeared in front of the Buddha early in the morning on the Vulture's Peak, people looking for down in the town down below would think there was a forest fire. And those are the sayings which are there. So maybe some of these very powerful minds, they are, appear like fires. Power, well, I think that's where the tapas comes from, because burning with fire gets a lot of energy, and obviously fire was a huge power for those days. It could also be that fire was used to purify metals, such as gold. So that might have been one of the similes, that the fires of jars could purify the heart from the defilements. No, the Buddha used that simile very much, with the mind being like impure gold. And by firing it, heating it up, you could actually purify the gold. Okay, so that's with the jhana bit. And usually I don't like reading sutras unless there's something with the jhana in it, and there's plenty of sutras for that. So that's, I got my happiness out of this sutta. Now we go to the five things again. Paragraph 18. Of those five things, student, that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome, which of the five they prescribe as the most fruitful for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome? Now, which is the best out of these? Of those five things, Master Gotama, that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for the accomplishing of the wholesome, they prescribe generosity as the most fruitful for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. What do you think, student? Here a Brahmin might be holding a great sacrifice, because that's what they thought of generosity. They held these huge animal sacrifices, and they still did that. And I know in Nepal, in Hindu Nepal, still create these animal sacrifices every year. And that was supposed to actually to have the longevity of the kingdom, of the kingship in Nepal. And obviously, you know, recent events, I think even the king of Nepal now, he's actually lost all power and all throne. I think they've chucked the monarchy out of Nepal. So obviously that never worked. And obviously it shouldn't work. Killing animals is not going to be meritorious at all. But that used to be thought by the Brahmins as a way of making merit. So what do you think, student? Here a Brahmin might be holding a great sacrifice, and two other Brahmins would go there thinking to take part in that great sacrifice. One Brahmin among them would think, oh, that only I might get the best heat, the best water, the best almond food in a refectory. That no other Brahmin might get the best seat, the best water, the best almond food in a refectory. Because they were proud. And it is possible that the other Brahmins, not that one, gets the best seat, water, almond food, and seat. Thinking about this, the first Brahmin might become angry and displeased. What kind of result do the Brahmins get for this? Now, they're doing generosity, but they're getting pride. Master Gotama, Brahmins do not give gifts in such a way, thinking let others become angry and displeased because of this. Rather, Brahmins give gifts motivated by compassion. That sounds very good. He's let himself in for a problem here. That being so, student, isn't this the Brahmin's sixth basis for the performance of merit? That is the motive of compassion. Oh, that being so, Master Gotama, this is the Brahmin's sixth basis for the performance of merit. That is the motive of compassion. You see that compassion is most important. Without compassion, where's the merit? Those five things, student, that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome. Where do you often see those five things? Among householders or among those gone forth? Those five things, Master Gotama, that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit for accomplishing the wholesome. What are they again? Here we go. They're truth, asceticism, celibacy. What's the other one? Generosity and... Sorry? Study, yeah. So those five things, Master Gotama, the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit for accomplishing the wholesome. I often see among those gone forth, seldom among householders, For the household is a great deal of activity, great functions, great engagements, and great undertakings. He does not constantly invariably speak the truth, practice asceticism, observe celibacy, engage in study, or engage in generosity. But while I've gone forward, they've got a small amount of activity, small functions, engagements, and undertakings. Not all people have gone forth, by the way. See how hard I have to work. He constantly and invariably speaks the truth, practices asceticism, observes celibacy, engages in study, and engages in generosity. Thus, those five things that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit for accomplishing the wholesome, I often see among those gone forth, seldom among householders. Those five things, students, that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit for accomplishing the wholesome, I call, this is another important point, equipment of mind. This is almost like a preparation of mind. Just like you have equipment before you go on an expedition. You know, you have all your suitcases before you go on a journey. This is all like the equipment and the necessary accompaniments for something bigger. That's what it means by equipment. The equipment of the mind, that is, for developing a mind that is without hostility and without ill will. It's a great point here. I'm going to pause. The five things. Now, things are such as truth, asceticism, celibacy, study, and what was the last thing? Generosity. These are actually equipment for developing a mind without hostility and ill will. Here, students, a monk is a speaker, or practitioner is a speaker of truth. Thinking, I'm a speaker of truth, you gain inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dhamma. You gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. In the meaning here, the atta is a very hard word to actually explain in English. It literally means where these things are going to, like the meaning of life, the purpose of it. So he gains gladness, I prefer here in this context, he gains gladness in the purpose. Well, this is an important thing, it's going to lead to wonderful things. He gets inspiration in the purpose, inspiration in the Dhamma, gladness connected with the Dhamma. It is that gladness connected with the wholesome that I call an equipment of the mind. This is the important things to develop first of all. Here, student, a bhikkhu is an ascetic, one is celibate, one engaged in study, one engaged in generosity. Thinking, I am one who engages in generosity. They gain inspiration in the purpose. They gain inspiration in the Dhamma. They gain gladness connected with the Dhamma. It is that gladness connected with the wholesome that I call an equipment of the mind. Thus, those five things that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome, I call equipment of the mind. That is, for developing a mind that is without hostility and without ill will. It's a brilliant, common teaching of the Buddha here. We do these things to get this gladness from inspiration. We get inspired what's happening and where it's all leading to. That leads to gladness. That is the equipment for overcoming the hindrances, getting into deep meditation, seeing the Dhamma, becoming enlightened. Now, how many times do I try and press on this with everybody? If your meditation is not working, you're not getting sort of deep in meditation, see, you know, where it's coming from. Are you making enough merits? You know, how are you getting inspiration in all the good and kind things you're doing? You know, there's so many people who really help out this place and look after it and work for it. They made all this merit, all this great, but they don't know how to turn this into inspiration. So sometimes it's great to pause, you know, when you're counting the cash on a Monday morning, when you're doing sort of the membership, you know, when you're just sweeping or you're just answering all the emails, you know, as a secretary. You pause, or you're driving the monk from place to place, pause and think, what are you doing? How are you really helping others? How are you actually creating this amazing Dhamma? I told a few people that last Thursday, for example, the Thursday before, this lady came all the way from Switzerland to see me. She, all the way from Switzerland, just to see me, because she was in a real bad state. Anxiety, complex, panic attacks, depression, seeing the doctor, seeing the shrink, nothing was working. And somehow or other she got hold of a copy of that book, Open the Door of Your Heart, in German. And that just changed her life She was free of all her pills, got over her depression and anxiety, and she wanted to come personally to say thank you. So she came all the way from Switzerland to Bodhinyana Monastery with her book, told me her story, and said, "Would it offend you," she asked me, "if you signed my book for me?" "Of course not." So I took hold of her book, and as I signed it, she started crying. Because that was what she came all the way for. Now, you're not doing this just because it's me. It's all of you can actually support this. We're a team. I might be out in front, but I wouldn't be able to do this without all the people behind. So as a team there, we get inspiration in this. What an amazing thing. We're changing people's lives. And really for the better, for the good. Wonderful. We get inspired. And that inspiration gives us gladness. Now if you sat down and meditated now, if you're really inspired, it's easy to meditate when you're inspired. So all of you who have done really good acts of karma, when you start your meditation, get into it, indulge in it, really sort of squeeze it for all it's worth. And you find your meditation takes off. Buddha calls this equipment for developing a mind without hostility and ill will. You get really inspired. And that inspiration is the cause for enlightenment. So those of you who are doing good stuff, don't waste it. Just think about it. Dwell upon it. Get inspired. Wow, this is really good. I'm doing something for the world. It's amazing. And then you get heaps and heaps of energy. It's often torpid. Can't come up at all. And also you get this beautiful energy. It's connected with the wholesome. And that is a mind, for developing a mind without hostility, without ill will. Any comments on that? No, I usually do. Yeah, sorry? Oh, yeah. Really get into it. Because some of the passions come from a wholesome state. We call it compassion or dispassion or whatever. But if it's coming from the unwholesome state, the passion is just what amplifies it and adds energy to whatever source. So, you know, obviously if you're angry and you get into passion, you're in a lot of problem. If you've got lust to get into passion, you do all sorts of amazing, crazy things. But, you know, if you've got the passion for your meditation, yeah, get into it. Oh, this is good, yeah. So, we're almost, oh no, I've got quite a bit to go yet. Amazing. 22. When this was said, the Brahmin student Subha, Tadaya's son, said to the Blessed One, "Master Gotama, I've heard the recluse Gotama knows the path of the company of Brahma." And this was the main thing which the Brahmins wanted. They just wanted to be in the company of God. So, if this is Brahma meant the equivalent, pretty much the equivalent of the Christian idea of God. So, if you want to be in unity with God, if you want to go to heaven, what do you actually do? You don't have to just believe in Jesus or believe in God. This is how the Buddha said, if you want to have union with God, this is what you have to do. But first of all, the Buddha sort of gives his authority to speak like this. What do you think, student, is the village of, let's say not Nalaka, is the village of Serpentine, near here or not far from here? So the village of Serpentine is near here, not far from here, well, Australian distances. What do you think, student? Suppose there was a man born and raised, isn't there another simile, what's say South Perth, a few of you are from South Perth. What do you think, student? Suppose there was a person born and raised in the village of South Perth, and as soon as he had left South Perth, they asked him about the path to South Perth. Would that man be slow or hesitant in answering? No, Master Gotama. Why is that? Because that man has been born and raised in South Perth, and is well acquainted with all the paths to South Perth. Still, a man born and raised in the village of South Perth might be slow or hesitant in answering when asked about the path to the village. But a Tathagata, when asked about the Brahma world or the way leading to the Brahma world, would never be slow or hesitant in answering. I understand Brahma, student, and I understand the Brahma world, and I understand the way leading to the Brahma world, and I understand how one should practice to reappear in the Brahma world. Master Gotama, he says again, I have heard that the recluse Gotama teaches the path of the company of Brahma. It would be good if Master Gotama would teach me the path of the company of God. Then, student, listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, sir, he replied. The Blessed One said this. What, student, is the path to the company of God? Here, monk or person abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with metta, loving kindness. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth, east, south, west, and north. So above, below, around, and everywhere. And to all as to himself. Remember, metta has to go to yourself, not just to other people. And to all as to yourself. No more than no less. You abide pervading the all-encompassing with mind, with a mind imbued with metta. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. When the deliverance of mind by loving kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there, just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too when the deliverance of mind by loving kindness is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there, none persists there. This is the path to the company of Brahma. Now there's one important word there which doesn't come out in Pali. Great reading these things in Pali. With a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable. The exalted here is Mahagata, and because one of the first things which I really learned as a monk was the Vinaya, Mahagata was the word for jhana. So this is a metta jhana here. When it says not just ordinary loving kindness, but a mind of loving kindness which is abundant, vipula, and gonjita jhana, is therefore immeasurable. So that is the degree of metta which you have to develop to have the union with a god. And anyone who develops either metta jhana or these other jhanas here, that jhana experience, if you make much of it, develop it, that will take you into the Brahma realms, the jhana realms. That's in the company of Brahma, of God. So the way to get to God in Buddhism, if that's all you wish to go, exactly the same way, doing the jhanas, not believing in a person or going evangelizing and saying hallelujah, that doesn't get you anywhere. It gets into trouble, makes you a pain in the backside. But by developing loving kindness, immense to the point of jhanas, then that is how you can get union with God. And anyone who has got into a jhana can understand, you know, why people will actually call that union with God, with a powerful. Again, a person abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with karuna, with compassion, with a mind imbued with appreciative joy, the mudita, with a mind imbued with equanimity. These are called the four Brahma Viharas, the abidings of God, of Brahma. Likewise, the second, the third, the fourth quarter, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all, as to themselves, they abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity, abundant, gone to jhana, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. When the deliverance of mind also is a key word meaning a jhana, the deliverance of mind by equanimity, the equanimity jhana, is developed in this way. No limiting action remains there. None persists there. Just as a vigorous trumpeter could make himself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when the deliverance of mind by equanimity is developed in this way, no limiting action remains there. None persists there. This too is the path to the company of Brahma. Any questions about that? I know someone once asked, yeah, if you metta jhanas or karuna jhanas, are they different from the jhanas, say, which you arrive from Anapanasati? And basically, there's no difference at all. Jhana is a jhana. It's just the way in is different. To get into each one of these, you still get into those nimittas, and through that beautiful metta-nimitta, you get into a jhana. It's just the way in. It just makes it different. Comments? Okay, here we go. When this was said, the Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, who actually abused the Buddha before, got fed up with him because he said the Brahmins were just like a file of blind men. The Brahmin student Subha, Todaya's son, said to the Blessed One, Magnificent Master Gotama, Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overturned, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, to the Dharma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus. Let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who's gone to him for refuge for life. And now, Master Gotama, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. Now is the time, student, do as you see fit. Then the Brahmin student, Subhatadaya's son, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat and having paid homage to the Blessed One, kept him on his right, he departed. That was a sign that he was a disciple now, keeping him to the right. That's why whenever we do a circumambulation, we keep the object of reverence to the right. And sometimes people will do that. Like I say, the Buddha there, they go around him three times, keep him to the right, and then they would leave. That's actually the circumambulation. So sometimes I've seen, I remember going to Sri Lanka once, and I couldn't believe it. It's just in the main, it's at Anuradhapura, these great big dagobas, these great pagodas with relics of the Buddha inside, and people were just walking around the wrong way. Just, you know, with the left side, and actually tradition, that was a real mark of disrespect to the Buddha. So if you're going around one of the great pagodas, objects of worship, make sure you always go around with your right shoulder facing that. So when you go to the nuns' monastery, if you walk around Sister Sally or someone, walk around her, the side, whatever it is, to her. Keep her on your right. Now, on that occasion, a Brahmin Janasoni was driving out of Sarvati in the middle of the day in an all-white chariot drawn by white mares. Now, remember, these Brahmins were very rich. And like a white chariot with white mares, that's like a Rolls Royce. Now, that's like a Ferrari in those days, because they had chariots and they had horses. And this is the way they really showed off their wealth. And that would be their vehicles. So an all-white chariot drawn by all-white mares. He saw the Brahmin student Subhatodaya's son come in the distance and asked him, "Now where is Master Bharadwaja," that's like his surname, his clan, "coming from in the middle of the day?" "Sir, I am coming from the presence of the recluse Gotama." "What does Master Bharadwaja think of the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom? Is he wise or is he not?" "Sir, who am I to know the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom? One would surely have to be his equal to know the recluse Gotama's lucidity of wisdom." "Oh, Master Bharadwaja praises the recluse Gotama with high praise indeed." "Sir, who am I to praise the recluse Gotama? The recluse Gotama is praised by the praised as best among gods and humans. Sir, those five things that the Brahmins prescribe for the performance of merit, for accomplishing the wholesome, the recluse Gotama calls equipment of the mind. That is, for the development of a mind that is without hostility, without ill will. Not for some merit in a future life, but to get your act together now." When this was said, the Brahmin Janasoni got down from his all-white chariot drawn by white mares, which is something. And after arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and uttered this exclamation, "It is a gain for King Prasenadi of Kosala. It is a great gain for King Prasenadi of Kosala that the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, lives in his realm." And there ends the Subha Sutta. So that was just an encounter with a proud Brahmin. All the encounters here, most of them were proud people, simply because they thought they were the bee's knees. In India at the time. And eventually they became the most prominent of the caste. And they did have a lot of study to perform, and they did it very well. But a lot of times it was study of text, as I always call it. It was the eating of menus, not ordering of the food. So the Buddha said there's more to it than that. And the Buddha, in a long discourse, taught them, you know, how that these five things for making merit are great. But make sure you do them as a cause. The gladness of the mind, which leads to the development of the mind. Without hostility, without ill will, leading into jhanas and seeing these supernormal things for yourself. So, any comments or questions about that? Yes, John, I always expect a nice question from you. Yeah. Equanimity. The word actually means upekkha. Literally means looking on. That's what it really means. Looking on without reacting at all. So this is the ability. And obviously some people say,
Yeah, but what about if you saw a child being raped? Or if you saw someone being abused? Is equanimity the right thing to do? And of course, you don't always practice equanimity, you know, 24 hours of the day. Even the Buddha doesn't practice equanimity all times of the day. Otherwise, when he wanted to go to the toilet, he would think, well, it's all the same going here or going over there. You don't just look on. You do things properly. You do your duties and responsibilities. So even arahats have desires, you know, and preferences, you know, where they drop their bundle. They've got to say things like that just to make it clear that people remember. Otherwise, you know, people think that enlightened beings have got no preferences, no views. Everything is all the same. Yeah, it was some really weird things. I did hear that when Bhagawan was in Perth, or when his disciples, they had their centre over in Fremantle, and they had, like, co-sexual toilets. So it wasn't like men's toilets or women's toilets. They all went to the same place. And also they had no partitions between the toilet bowls. So just a big line of toilet bowls in one room, and you could sit next to whoever you wanted. That's an interesting thing. I don't know if that was very skillful. Whatever. Anyways, I don't know why I brought that one up, but where did that one come from? But anyway, with equanimity, I mean, just looking on. And you only do this when it's the right time and place of equanimity. So this is actually a way of developing the mind, especially in meditation. No preferences. No judging. Equanimity, whatever you're looking at, this is good enough. Just look on. In other words, like bare mindfulness, a silent watcher. A sort of equanimity. And whatever you watch, great meditation, your mind is even. Terrible meditation, your mind is even. So you keep this even mind no matter what you're watching. That's just looking on. That's the literal meaning of upekkha. Does that make any sense? Yeah. So if you can't do anything about it, then be peaceful. If it's something you can do, go and do it, for goodness sake. As long as you're not going to make it worse. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Okay. No comments or questions? We're going to finish off right now. Okay, so before we actually finish off, the next advanced Dhamma class or Siddha class will be in 2 weeks' time. Podabi's sister, if she comes back, she's in Sydney at the moment. Any news yet, Jackie? Is she going to be back in time? Okay, yeah, okay. So she'll be the next one. But I know that I got a memory that the last time I did a Sutta class, someone asked me, can I do a particular Sutta? It was, yeah? Oh, the Rahula Sutta. Okay, this time I'm going to write it down. Which one? Because there's two Rahula. Sorry? Okay, 64. Okay, the next time I'm going to do one, it'll be 64. If all of the conditions are correct. Huh? No, not 64, that's Mahamalunga. The Rahula Wada Sutta. Which one is it? 62. Yeah, okay, number 62. Okay, that'll be the next time when I'm here, maybe in a month's time. 62. So anyway, that Super Sutta was especially for somebody who emailed, I've never done any of these suttas about Brahmins or kings. Now I have. Ha ha. Okay, now we can pay respects to the Buddha, and then we can go and do what you need to do.
Arahant Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.